And now our conversation turns to a story that has been developing since last Wednesday. Six people have been killed, one seriously wounded, in a series of sniper attacks, all in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. This morning, a 13-year-old boy was shot and wounded outside his school in Bowie, Maryland, not far from Washington. Police have not yet linked this attack to the other shootings. Still, today's shooting has heightened the sense of fear in the region and has put even more pressure on law enforcement to find the shooter. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, if you have any questions about the case, how the police are handling it, give us a phone call. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address, totn@npr.org. Joining us now on the line is Greg McCary. He's with us from his office in Fredericksburg, Virginia. He's a retired FBI profiler, currently director of Behavioral Criminology International, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
Is this a serial killer, the definition of the term?
Well, it's the best way to conceptualize this is a sort of a subtype of a serial killer. And it's serial in that there's one event following another in a series. But the difference is the sort of the lack of an emotional cooling off period. A traditional serial killer often has days and weeks and months sometimes between individual homicides. And this started as a very high intensity spree shooting initially and seems to have slowed down a little bit since then. But it's more of a spree sort of a killer than the traditional serial killer.
Are there any relevant examples that you can point to?
Similar cases?
Yeah.
You mean, yeah. Well, we had probably people are familiar with Andrew Cunanan a few years ago was on a cross-country sort of a spree and was killing people in a number of states from the California on through and finally killing Versace in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
We had Benjamin Smith. That was a little bit different. He shot 11 people and killed two in 3 days in Indiana and Illinois. But that was those victims were minorities. He was a white supremacist and had targeted minorities for his shooting spree. We don't seem to have that sort of a victimology or victim pattern in this case. There's another sort of really infamous case that we're, most people are not familiar with here in Australia, where an individual named Martin Bryant had killed 35 people. He started at 1:30 in the afternoon on a Sunday and finished at about 8:30 the next morning, Monday morning, but had killed 35 people in that time period. So these are spree killers. They're different than mass murderers too. I've seen that confused in the media. Mass murderer it's all one event. They stay sort of stationary or in one place and kill until they're either killed or captured. Some people have talked about Charles Whitman in the tower down at Austin. That's really a mass murder. It's a little bit different than the spree sort of murder, which is different people in different areas at different times.
Now, could this be, some reports indicated that there may have been two people involved. Could they be more than one person?
There could be, yes. I can't imagine more than two people be interested in doing something like this, but we've had pairs of these individuals and taking turns, sort of a tag team, one driving, one shooting, and then switching, that sort of thing. So we certainly can't rule that out. And I think the important thing here is because the lack of real specific information about these crimes, we want to be careful that we don't get tunnel vision, that we don't get too constricted a view of who we're looking for.
Is there all the people you mentioned were men and men are mm-hmm. responsible for most of these kinds of killings, of
sure.
course. That would be consistent, you think?
Yes. I'd be very surprised if this were a woman or a couple of women out there. But, yeah, statistically, certainly males are far more violent and do this sort of thing. Now, there have been female killers, obviously, in the past, but just statistically speaking, it's more likely to be a male.
What do you make of the fact that these are all killings apparently done with a high-powered hunting-type rifle from a distance? What does that tell you about the killer?
Right. It's a 223 weapon. Now, that particular round it's actually a very, very popular round. I mean, it's a military round for the M16. The FBI uses it in their M16 weapons and 223 weapons, but also the U.S. Olympic team uses it in competition, and a lot of hunters and sportsmen, target shooters use it as well. So it's a very popular round. But the key here is that these killings are being done in a very cold, predatory distance type of a manner here rather than up close. Some killers want to look into the eyes of their victims and see the fear and that sort of thing. And that we're completely devoid of any of that type of motivation here. This is a person who's shooting from a distance, who isn't engaging the target in any way other than just as a target. They're not using some sort of con or ruse or approaching them or talking to them or doing any of those sorts of things, just engaging them, completely catching them completely unaware and then shooting from a distance. The feedback will be, or the payoff for this guy will be, the feedback from the media, seeing exactly what he's done after it's over and the sort of chaos that he's created, as well as the fear that he's instilled in the community and all of that sort of thing. So that's really the payoff, and I think when we rule out the other motivations, typical motivations like robbery or sexual assault or things, we're down to this sort of thrill of killing the individuals and that sort of thing, which I think is probably primarily the motive.
Our number again is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's go now to Linda, who's in Silver Spring, Maryland, not too far away from where this most recent shooting was.
Hi. I work at a public high school in Montgomery County. So as you can imagine, emotions are running rather high there. And a number of people have been putting around the theory, for example, that this is the work of terrorists, which I personally don't agree with, but I was wondering if that's part of the scenario with which Mr. McCrary is talking. And I have a second question if there's time.
Sure. Okay, Mr. McCrary?
Right. It's terrorism only, I think, in the broadest sense, in that we have isolated acts of violence that are instilling fear into a larger community. But as far as having some religious or social or political objective, I think we're not seeing any of that. Usually when it's a terrorist group, there's some sort of claim or some connection that's made pretty readily because they want credit for this. They want you to know that they're striking a blow for their cause and so forth, and we haven't had any of that at all. So I think that's a less likely possibility.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Linda.
Okay, thank you. Well, I mean, that actually is something that I would believe in as well, but... Mm-hmm. Because people are speculating fairly wildly, I had a question as to whether you think the school systems are acting appropriately. I kind of have observed that students at all levels may possibly be being unnecessarily frightened. And I realize that might be a little bit out of your area of expertise.
I'm not sure exactly what the schools are doing. It's difficult for students not to be frightened or for the community not to be anxious about what's going on, because the sense of vulnerability, we're all vulnerable by choosing victims in this most apparently random manner of men and women and minorities and Caucasians, and now if this other one is related, now we have a child shot, then we all sense our vulnerability, and that's unfortunately what this individual is trying to do, is make us feel very vulnerable and very afraid, and to a degree certainly has accomplished this, but I think that the approach is just to be very deliberative in what the investigators are doing, and that is what they're doing, and keep in mind that overall the chance of actually encountering this individual is really statistically very small, although he's out there and the fear is there. There's no doubt about it.
Mm. Okay, thank you very much.
Linda, thanks very much for the call, and hang in there.
Bye-bye.
Okay. We are talking with former FBI profiler Greg McCrary about the series of shootings that have occurred, one in and several just outside of Washington, D.C. over the past week or so, in which at least six people have been killed and at least one other injured. One other shooting today, and so far there's no indication that it's been tied specifically to this case, but obviously there's a lot of suspicions. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Mark, who's on the line from Springfield, Virginia.
Hi. I just had a comment when Greg mentioned that obviously this fellow was out for media coverage and payback, that I was a little surprised when the coverage on the television last week all of a sudden jumped to schools and lockdown at the schools. Did we sort of precipitate that schools being a target, and sort of due to the coverage that was, as I say, sort of the schools became a forefront of the news, and then I'm just sort of concerned that if the schools were so important last week, again, hindsight being what it is, that maybe the police should have followed through this week in terms of coverage of the schools, maybe having cruisers out in front of the schools. Just sort of wanted to comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly I do think the offender is following the media, and the media is never just a impartial observer in a situation like this, because the offender will be reacting to what he sees on the news. Now, I don't know, you know, we can't say if he targeted schools because he saw this, or even if he's targeted schools at all, because the one shooting this morning, we still don't know if it's related or not. But in a worst-case scenario, let's assume the scenario that it is related, it's hard to know whether that would have been a result of, an idea planted by the media, or if this was just another attempt by him to move to a nearby community and pick a different type of victim, just to continue with this pattern of randomness and instill fear in the community.
Okay.
Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We've heard that police are using something called a geographic profile to
yes.
try to help figure out who this guy might be, and again, we're assuming it's a guy. Can you explain how that works and why it might be necessary in a case like this?
It can be helpful. Keep in mind that, like the behavioral profiling the FBI does, the geographic profiling is a tool. It isn't going to solve the case, but it can be a tool that will help prioritize suspects and maybe give focus to the investigation. What's done in a geographic profile is that they, whenever you have a series of crimes like this across, an area, there's a computer program that Kim Rossmo, who's the director of research at the Police Foundation now, has developed. It's really quite helpful. That, and then actually going to the crime sites and looking at the details of the environment, the geographic profiler then can come up with an area of interest in a community, which will probably be a type of anchor point for the individual. It could be a place that he lives or works. But what this does is help focus the investigation. So if people are calling in, which they are with leads, say leads about, from the behavioral perspective, an emotionally unstable individual with access to a .223 type of weapon, and then who lives or works in that area, that would be the type of lead that would go to the surface and be one of the leads covered first. It would be prioritized. So it can be helpful in that regard. Keep in mind now that the investigators are getting hundreds, if not thousands of leads in, and rather than just wading through them without any ability to prioritize, the profiling allows those leads to be prioritized, and they can go to the most promising ones first.
Let's go now to Michael, who's with us from Kansas City. Hello, Michael. You there?
Yes. I just wanted to make an observation. This sounds very much like the objective of a popular video game right now called Grand Theft Auto 3. A part of the game is literally to take a high-powered rifle, drive around the city, and execute people. Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. McCrary?
Yes. Yeah, I don't know the game personally. I've heard of it. And again, this is always sort of the relationship. Is there some relationship between violent video games and violent media to violence in general?
I'm remembering in the late 70s, early 80s, we had a huge media coverage over some kids who snapped over playing Dungeons and Dragons and ended up doing some pretty incredible stuff that ended up getting some people killed also. I'm just mm-hmm. kind of wondering if this whole connection might have been considered.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that it is. What we find is that certainly playing a violent video game or looking at a violent movie isn't going to make most of us become violent. But what we find are people that are prone to violence may immerse themselves in these aggressive games because it validates their behavior, and it can have a reinforcing effect. But at most, I think we could say is that these things may in some way be contributory, but I don't know that they're causative, that they cause anyone to go do it. But it could be a factor or something to consider, sure.
Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Greg McCrary, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Greg McCrary is a retired FBI profiler, currently director of Behavioral Criminology International, and he was on the line with us from his office in Fredericksburg, Virginia. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.